Okay, we'll continue here in chapter 37. Yeah, we had basically two problems here.
Yeah. Jealousy, you want to say that the jealousy is a different sort of a jealousy, like someone killing someone with a battle of
Aquaman? Not exactly, but similar. We'll see right away. You see, the main problem here is really that when jealousy is supposed to be mentioned, it's not. And I'm referring here to verse number 4. That when the brother saw, verse number 4 of chapter 37, when the brother saw that his father loved him, they hated him. According to the conventional wisdom, we would have said, if you see something that his father, their father loves him more than he loves anybody else, it should be jealousy, their reaction, more than hatred. And later on, after the second dream, we find in verse number 11 that there is no hatred there, but there is a vayikanu bo echav, jealousy there in verse number 11, when what, according to conventional wisdom, the normal reaction should have been, if he says that the sun and the moon and everybody will bow down to him, that should bring about the reaction of anger, of hatred. So, and we added to this problem the famous question which is asked by the tefillah, by the prayer of the Berchat Kohanim, that we say that God should give us grace. We should find favor in people's eyes, lechein ulchezer rachim, in your eyes and in people's eyes, like Yosef when he received the ktonet pasim, when he received the shirt. And we see that the reaction in the Torah is the exact opposite. That's what created the whole problem on the surface. That's what we might think. So, in one of the classical commentaries of the Torah, one of the classical Hasidic commentaries, the Sfat Emet, he points out the following. If you take a look here, Sfat Emet, lips of truth, or it really means Sefat, it means Sfatimet, that's what he's known as. You see, in verse number 10, when Rashi comments on the words Vayigar Bo, this is the second Rashi on verse number 10, that Yaakov screamed at him. Second of all, what is the content of the scream of Yaakov? The content is, Havon Ovo, do you think that we, I and your mother and your brothers will come and bow down to you? So what is Yaakov doing? Yaakov is doing two things. Number one, he's screaming. Number two, he's saying whatever he's saying. He's saying that it's impossible that your mother should come. Says Rashi, you know why he's screaming? Lefi shehaya matil sina'a alav. Because of the sina'a, because of the hatred, he was screaming. Now, how are we to understand that somehow his screaming took care of the hatred? Right? What does one have to do with the other? So the Sefat Emet says the following principle. If, for instance, there is another person, let's say I'm a very jealous person, right? And I hear that someone is showing off that he has a lot of money, and I'm a very jealous person, right? And I know that he's just showing off. He really has no money. Okay? He doesn't have any money. But he's showing off as if he has money. He's talking as if he has money. What should be my reaction? Is there room for jealousy there? Says the Sefat Emet, you can't be jealous of someone who doesn't have what you want. Jealousy is something that you feel when someone else has what you want. Right? So by being jealous, you are recognizing a certain superiority. Otherwise, the word jealous, the concept of jealousy, wouldn't fit in. This is what he says. Therefore, if his father loves him, and it's all for nothing, they don't see in him anything special, so the reaction can be hatred. I hate you for showing off that you have money when really you don't. But I can't be jealous. Okay? What about after the second dream, says the Sefat Emet, right? We don't know how the brothers reacted to the second dream. We know how the father wanted the brothers to react after the second dream. How does the father want the brothers to react to Joseph's telling of the dream? That it's a bunch of nonsense, don't worry about it. Okay? That's what should be, that's what Yaakov wants. But in reality, does Yaakov succeed in convincing the brothers that it's a bunch of nonsense? He does not succeed. They sense that there is a lot to it, and therefore they have to act upon it. Okay? Therefore, if you pay attention to Rashi, it's so exact the wording of Rashi here. The hatred comes about because obviously Yosef is putting on a show that he's special for his father. Isn't that what they are thinking? Why does our father love Yosef more than everybody else? Obviously he's putting on a show that he has certain qualities that we don't. This is why our father loves him. He's his favorite. This is why this aroused hatred. So when Yaakov screams at Yosef, what is he showing? What is the point that Yaakov is making when he screams at Yosef? You are not my favorite anymore. How can you say such a thing? Which means if the Torah describes what Yaakov says as screaming, that means that Yaakov is going against the feeling of the brothers that you are my favorite. Therefore, perhaps I'm hoping there won't be any hatred anymore. But what about the feeling that perhaps now after the second dream, the brothers will think, maybe there is something special about Yosef. Maybe he is really superior. So how does Yaakov try to destroy that possibility? By saying, no, the dream is nonsense because the moon can't be anybody. But what about the brothers themselves? True. Perhaps there is much less hatred. Perhaps the hatred went away the moment what? The father screamed. But what about this new feeling? What is the new feeling? There is something to Yosef. He has special qualities. That makes him even more dangerous. This is the Vayikanu. This is how the Sefat Emet understands the Rashi and how he understands how originally there is no jealousy. Because they don't recognize that there is anything special about Yosef. And when he does say Kina, that means that there is something special about Yosef. Now.
What does this have to
Kina? With what? No. This answers the original question. The original question was, why wasn't there jealousy in the beginning and now we do find jealousy? Now. Exactly, says it. Vayigar, he screamed at him. And Rashi says, because of the hatred. Right? What is the connection between screaming because of the hatred? That is the connection. By screaming at him, he's destroying the cause of the hatred. Remember, the cause of the hatred is that the father showed favoritism to Yosef. Now that the father screams at Yosef, somehow they see, listen, if he's really his favorite, he wouldn't have screamed at him. Okay? So Yaakov wanted to take care of all the problems. He couldn't. He didn't succeed because there was jealousy. Now, we find that in Yosef, right, something which is very, very special. In reality, we believe that the brothers, when they realize that Yosef is a superior being, he is a superior being, and from the dream, they sense that he's a superior being. This doesn't make him any less dangerous. As a matter of fact, you know who else is called the hated one? We pointed out. Who else? Leah was called the hated one. And we said, you know why Leah is called the hated one? Not because she was really hated, but because she was the soulmate of whom?
Esau,
who was the hated one. And this is how in Trei Asar, in the Bible, in the book of Trei Asar of Ovadiah, it says, Sonuyato, he's the hated one. Esau is the hated one. Who else is called the hated one? Yosef, right? Yosef is hated. So the commentaries say, you know where is the parallel here? The brothers figured out the following. There are three patriarchs. Why are there three patriarchs? Because the process of establishing the Jewish people requires three generations. It was known already. Now, Every patriarch has something wrong with him, and whatever is wrong with him is polarized to the other extreme. Like, for instance, Abraham, right? There is something wrong with Abraham, and there is something very right with Abraham. So everything which is wrong with Abraham, so to speak, is polarized towards Ishmael. Well, so the process must continue. Yitzchak, where does his bad part, so to speak, become polarized so that his son can become Yaakov? Esau. Well, the process must continue for another generation, probably. Therefore, Yaakov is also going to have one son, that he's going to be the third generation. Ishmael, Esau. Who is that son? Well, we have one sign. You see, for instance, the father, Yitzchak, was misled, and he loved that son, which was really the bad son, more than all the other sons. So perhaps that is the sign, that is the pattern. Right? So now they put everything together. Yosef shows off that he's a tzaddik, he's a righteous man. You know who else used to show off that he's a righteous man? Esau. Esau used to show off by asking, you know, very specific questions about how to behave, when in reality he couldn't care less. Well, that is part of the pattern, and Yosef does something very similar. Esau was the favorite of the father. Yosef is the favorite of the father. Therefore, Yosef is the last generation of impurity that has to be cleansed out from the Jewish people. Therefore, we can just sit back and allow God's will to work itself out, or we can take matters into our own hands. After all, once we came to Israel, matters were given over to our own hands, as we see. As soon as they come to Shechem, who makes the decisions? The brothers. Therefore, they say, we, as the Jewish people, should take matters into our own hands. Now, what is the legal status of someone like Ishmael, like Esav, and in their minds, Yosef? They are called rodefim, pursuers. Pursuers. So, well, because Ishmael, right, had in mind to destroy the Jewish people. Esav has in mind to destroy the Jewish people. Probably this is exactly what Yosef wants to do if he's the third one in the chain of impurity.
Don't you have to know that
well, what about presenting this case in such a way? Listen, there must be a third generation of impurity. We see all the signs of Esav in Yosef. Doesn't it make sense then that he is the Rodef? Besides, by telling us the dream, he is saying that he wants to be the king of Israel. Now, we have a king, by the way, at this point already. This group had already chosen the tribe of Judah as their leader. We have proof later on. Maybe, perhaps, we'll talk about it. Now, if Yosef denies the centrality, the power of Yehuda, then there is another law that we can rely upon, and that is the law of Moreid Bemalchut. Anyone in Israel, even if he's a righteous man, right? So much more so if he's not so righteous. But even a righteous man who demands the kingdom, the monarchy for himself, against the will of the people, when there is already a monarch, he is considered a Moreid Bemalchut, a rebel against the kingdom, and you are allowed to put him to death. That is the law of the Moreid Bemalchut. Therefore, bringing all these facts together, is it surprising that they decide that legally he deserves the death penalty? It's really not surprising at all. Not surprising at all. Because they had a perfect case for it, right? And they had the power for it. They were the Jewish people. Remember, the Sanhedrin. Can they pass the death penalty? What gives them the power? They represent the Jewish people. So if they represent the Jewish people and they can pass the death penalty, what about the Jewish people in total? If all the Jewish people would decide to kill someone, then for sure they have that power. Who are the tribes? The Jewish people. They are deciding Yosef is a rodef, is a pursuer, so therefore we can get rid of him. So this is the basis for this legal decision. Okay, and in reality, they had a reasonable case. I mean, it's not that they don't have a good case. They have a good case. We say in retrospect that they were wrong, that all those signs were incorrect. But this is the case they made. And what happens at the end? They do not kill him. Even though in the beginning they decide to kill him, they change their minds. Right? He comes to Potiphar's house. Right? He's sold into Egypt. And right away he's given the highest position. Immediately he rises to the top. Then again he's put in jail. The jail of the ministers. What happens there? Immediately everybody trusts him and he goes to the top. He goes to Pharaoh's house. Goes all the way to the top. Right? And again, this the Sefat Emet says, if you pay attention to certain expressions that we find by Yosef, you'll figure out right away the similarity. Yosef is brought to Pharaoh's house, and immediately he's given the special chariot, and people run in front of him saying, you know, here comes, you know, the viceroy of the king, right? And he saves the Jewish people. You know who else? What is the other similarity? Somebody else. Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai and Esther, right? The team of Mordechai and Esther. We find a lot of similarities between Mordechai and Esther and Yosef. Now, do you know what it says in the Megillat Esther, in the scroll of Esther? What was the special power of Esther? Her special power was, and in the words of the rabbis, when it says that it's not that she was so beautiful, as she had a tremendous capacity for finding favor in people's eyes. That's what it says, that she had an enormous capacity of finding favor. It says that Yosef had this incredible capacity. This is why whoever met him naturally trusted him, right? Of course, that capacity sometimes arouses by other people who dislike you. Of course, it can arouse jealousy too. But it's all from the same source, that tremendous power to have influence over people. This is what Yosef had. Now, there is another concept here. There is a concept which in our literature is called segula. Samach gimel vav lamed hei. Segula means certain things that a person does in order to get like special blessings. You probably never saw that, like a certain amulets that people would wear for a certain purpose. Right, meaning it doesn't work through the normal natural system that we live by. Right, it's another system that some people believe in, it the system of segula. And I once described it, you know, that everybody said there is a system of the natural law and there is the supernatural law, but it's not true. There is a third system, because supernatural law is described as a direct intervention of God. Right, supernatural law, you would say, for instance, the crossing of the Red Sea is supernatural law, supernatural interventions, definitely not natural law. But how would you describe, for instance, as an example, the statement by Nachmanides that a person at a very high level, very high spiritual level, if he gets ill, should not go to doctors because he doesn't need the natural system, right? Because the doctors work through the natural system. He doesn't need the natural system. He can go directly to the source. He can pray to God. He can go to the prophet and get cured. Now, what system is that if it's not the natural system? Would you call it the supernatural system? No, you're not allowed to rely on the supernatural system. If it comes, it comes. But you can't rely on it. We call it the meta-natural system, the system beyond the natural. And that includes, for instance, we have a tradition that when Moses killed the Egyptian, remember the story of Moses killing the Egyptian? It was not through the natural system of rule, meaning he didn't throw a stone at him or shoot him or put a knife into his back. What he did was that certain powers which exist in this world, not within the natural system, but certain powers exist, and certain people at a high spiritual level can use those powers to get certain things done in this world. Right? So it's not the supernatural system, because it doesn't mean a direct intervention of God. It's not the natural system, because definitely you can't describe it according to natural laws. It's a meta-natural system. It's a system beyond the natural, but it doesn't come to the supernatural system. This is the concept of segula. Segula, for instance, Yaakov used, remember, when he separated his flocks, that all dotted and striped sheep would be given to Laban, right? And he kept all the white ones, right? And then when the white ones would beget striped sheep, then they would know that it's his. And he did all kinds of things. He took a stick and he made signs, and through those signs that caused the sheep to have descendants that were striped and dotted. Now, there is no principle according to natural law by which this works. It just doesn't work. You ask a geneticist, he will tell you, you try it, it just won't work. Of course, according to the natural laws, it won't work. He wasn't even trying to use the natural system. What he was using is the power of segulot, which means certain actions that through the right concentration and through being in the right spiritual level, you can get things done in this world beyond breaking out of the natural system. Okay? And that's the principle behind the amulets that certain people believe in. Or exactly the red thing, perhaps against the Ayin Hara, against the evil eye, whatever that means. Now, the evil eye definitely does not work within the natural system. What is the evil eye? It's some principle that for those who believe in it, they believe in it that it works beyond the natural system. It's definitely not supernatural because it's not a direct intervention of God. I'm just trying to point out to you that whether we... What? Well, it's you know, there is such a statement in the Talmud in Psochim that concerning certain superstitions, he says, if you believe in it, it works, and if you don't believe in it, it won't work at all. Okay, it's true. It's true. Right. It is different. I mean, but I'm just telling you another type of superstition. Like, you know, the Talmud mentions the belief in the danger of odd numbers. Did you ever hear that? Okay, the Talmud says that there were people who believed in the danger of odd numbers, which means they would never eat one portion of something. I'm sorry, of even numbers, I'm sorry. That they would never eat two portions of something, either one or three. They wouldn't eat two, right? So the Talmud says, if you believe in it, it may actually damage you. Don't be surprised because you believe in it, right? What? No, rabbis didn't believe in it. I mean the masses of people, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, so those kind of superstitions depend on whether you believe it or not. But Ayin Hara is different. Ayin Hara, we believe in it. You know, that is a principle. This is something. But where does it work? In which system? Not in the natural system, not in the supernatural system. I'm just proving to you that there is such a middle system, in the middle. This, and we call it the system beyond the natural, but it's not actually supernatural. Yeah.
Three things there. First of all, you said that Ishmael could be related to Esau and to Joseph. But Ishmael wasn't the loved one. I think that Yitzhak was the loved
one.
That's why Hashem gave him the
test. You are right, but there was a time when Avram says to God, you know, Lu Ishmael, you know what? Give me Ishmael. Forget about anybody else. There was a time before Yitzhak is born. It's true. But it's still, there is a moment of favoritism.
Another thing, what I asked...
Right, fine. Okay.
What I asked you yesterday,
still favoritism.
I said, how come a brother like Yitzhak, like Yaakov, can set up three situations in which he knows that the other brothers are going to become angry at Yosef because, you know, making him the coat and the two other situations which were
right.
So how, I mean, you know,
right.
like
okay.
Yaakov,
so in reality is the exact opposite in what we think. The reason why Yaakov makes this coat for Yosef as a segula, in order to use that system, for chen, for finding favor in people's eyes. That was the purpose. He sensed that Yosef has special qualities, right? He taught him, he gave him the information, he should be able to use it, but he needed that people should naturally trust him. How do you make a person trustworthy, right? What medicine do you give him? What potion do you give? This was what Yaakov chose. So you see, if you read the verses carefully, it would even tell you what?
This coat was like a kameya.
Exactly, that's what it was. It was a segula, or what we call a kameya, a segula. So, and this is why it says, it says like this. Yosef, in verse number 3, V'Yisrael ohavet Yosef mikol banav, since he loved them more than all the other sons, ki ben zekunim hulo. Why? Because all the information that he had and he wanted to share it with the world. He figured Yosef will be the transfer of that information. But how will it be successful? This is why he gave him the Ktonet Pasim, to give him the power of influence, right? So when the brothers saw, not that they saw the shirt didn't cause the hatred. What caused the hatred is their thinking that he, Yosef, must have done something to mislead the father, that there is something special about him. They hated him. They weren't jealous of him. They hated him, right? But Yosef was given that special capacity. So therefore we shouldn't be surprised that Yosef's life is that. Of course he's hated by some, but his capacity to find favor is incredible. This is why he can come to Egypt, a foreigner, knowing nothing. He comes to the household of a minister and immediately he goes to the top. He's jailed together with the ministers and everybody trusts him. Nobody trusts anybody else and everybody trusts Yosef.
Even though he doesn't have school.
What?
He doesn't have
the thing is like this. The segulo doesn't work only when it's with you. Right? The giving of this segulo, the giving of this gulo by itself, the making it, is in itself the broche. It's called a poel dimion. When you want to give a broche to someone, like for instance, when Moshe wanted to sweeten the water, so he threw in something. If it's a miracle anyway, why does he have to throw in a branch? Because the action in itself is the carrier of the blessing. The making of the Ktonet Pasim, of this shirt, is in itself the blessing. But it's not that actually the shirt has any qualities at all. It's the action of giving him the shirt, which is a transfer of that special power. This is how the commentaries understand it. So, with this we can understand something else. How is it that Yaakov is convinced that at this point it's time to make peace between the brothers and Yosef? This is what it says in verse number 14. Vayomer lo, lechna re'e et shlom achecho. Shlom achecho is a hint. It doesn't only mean see how well they are doing. It means that you should see the shalom, you should find shalom with your brothers, and they should find shalom with you. Why would it occur to Yaakov that now is the time for peace? Because in his mind, he figured out the following. Obviously, they don't hate him anymore. Why? Because I screamed at him. So they have no reason to hate him anymore, right? Obviously, they are not jealous because I told them there is no reason to be jealous because the dream was nonsense. Therefore, it's safe now that they should get together. Okay? This is the reason why Yaakov thinks that now is the time for shalom. What he didn't know is what we know from verse number 11. Vayikanu bo echav, that the brothers did not pay attention to Yaakov's interpretation of the dream. They had their own interpretation of the dream, and this is why they decided to kill him. Yeah. Because when the moment he says, that's a bunch of nonsense, the dream, it will never happen. If so, Yosef doesn't have any superiority over the brothers, right? So the only possibility is that Yosef is trying to show up for the father. But if the father doesn't fall for it, he screams at him, then even that is gone. So therefore there is no reason whatsoever for the misunderstanding between the brother and Yosef, the brothers and Yosef. This is how Yaakov understands the situation right now. Now, let's go on. Yosef goes then, again, where is he going? To Shechem. He's going to Shechem to find the brothers. So the Torah tells me that there was a detour in the plan. Now remember, the Torah never tells me information just for the sake of curiosity. You know, we would be curious. Did he meet him in Shechem or didn't he meet him in Shechem? Well, that wouldn't be enough of a reason. And the Torah goes out of its way to tell you that there was a detour here. Here it is. in verse number 14, the last two words, Vayavo Shechema. He comes to Shechem. And in verse number 15, Vayimtza'ehu Ish. And a man finds him. Man finds him. Doesn't say a word who the man is. Vehinei so'e basadeh. Yosef is just wandering around. Where are my brothers? Vayish'aleyu ha'ish lemor. Matevakesh. What are you looking for? Vayomer. And he says, et achai anochi mevakesh. I'm looking for my brothers. Hagida nali eifo hem roim. You tell me, where are they tending the flock.
How does he know that he knows?
It's very interesting here. You see, you go over to a stranger and you say, have you seen my here? in Rashi, Rashi quotes the oral tradition here. Vaimtso'eyu ish, this wasn't a normal human being, obviously. That was a vision. A vision of an angel that Yosef had at the time. And who was this angel? Ze Gabriel. And we know that the word ish is a code word for Gabriel, because it's Veho ish Gabriel. Gabriel is defined as the man. The man. So therefore, we can understand how Yosef dares tell him, you know, I'm looking for my brothers. And he assumes, you know, that the ish will know who the brothers are. Of course. It was a vision and Yosef was aware of that. Now, it's interesting that Yosef wanders around looking for the brothers. Because, you know, if somebody tells you to do something very unpleasant, right, look for somebody that you don't really like. So you go over and you look for him for 2 minutes. He's not there, right? That's a perfect justification for going back without finding him. But Yosef wouldn't go back until he found them. Right? He didn't have to go looking around for the brothers. He has fulfilled his obligation. So this shows you again that Yosef is convinced that he's going to succeed in convincing the brothers of the veracity of the reliability of the dream. But it's interesting. They are not in Shechem anymore. Remember I told you? Why it was Shechem? I told you that Shechem is the special place in Israel where there is a tremendous danger of things falling apart, but because of that, that must be the place where the things that fell apart will get together again. Right? So, unfortunately, they weren't in Shechem anymore. Where did they go? Somewhere else. Some place called Dothan. In verse number 17. Kishamati amrim nelcho dotaina, vayelech Yosef acharechav, vaimtsa'eim bedotan. So therefore he's not in Shechem anymore, he's in Dothan.
When they say Shemati, was he asking a question? Like, even though he really asked, just said they're in Dothan.
Okay. Shemati omri, now it bothers you. What does it mean? I heard them say. I heard them say. So Rashi again has a meaning to the whole conversation of going to Dothan. Rashi said that the word Dothan, the word dat, dalet taf, you know what it means, dalet taf, what? Dalet ayin taf is knowledge, dalet taf is like a religion. And when it says, nilcho dotaina, says Rashi, levakesh lacha nichlei datot, sheyimitucha bahem, to find certain ways to kill you, which means, even if their beliefs don't allow it, they are looking for other beliefs that will allow it. So according to this, the angel Gabriel is hinting what? He's warning him, right? That's 100%. He's warning them. Dotaina, right? So kiyishomati means, I heard him planning your death. This is how Rashi understands it. Again, somebody else in his place. Sure, somebody else in his place. He would just take his feet and run. He went to Dothan.
Why wasn't it right?
He's convinced that he's going to succeed. He's convinced he's going to succeed. He has a mission. He's a man with a mission. In verse number 18, Vayiru oto merachok uveterem mikrav aleichem aleihem vayitnaklu oto lamito. Before he came to them, they already decided to kill him. Now, this is considered a criticism to the brothers. We consider that at this point the decision is made. When they see him coming, they get together and they say, okay, let's make the decision, and the decision is made. However, they didn't give him a chance to defend himself. So this is what it says. Beterem, even before he came, not after he came and they allowed him a chance to defend himself. Didn't allow a chance to defend himself, they decided to kill him. And in verse number 19, Vayomru eshel echa achiv, hinei bala chalomot ala zeba. The man of the dreams. Interesting, they don't say the man of the shirt. So again, so what bothered him most? not the shirt at all, right? Just the opposite. The shirt was a power to find favor. It's the dreams that bother them. So therefore, in verse number 20, Vata lechu v'nehargeyu, let's kill him, v'nashlicheyu b'chad haborot, we'll throw him into a pit. And what are we going to do with our obligations to our towards our father? Well, simple. Amanu chaya ra'a chalatu. We will say that he was torn up. He was killed by a wild animal. You mean to say, let's put it another way. You're saying, well, after all, we know that brothers can be judges, right? Can be judges. Brothers can be witnesses, right? Why? Because they are no gebedar. They have because they are too close to the situation, so they can't make judgments. Okay. Now, this is only when the Jewish people, right? Meaning, there is another very interesting point. The Torah prohibits people to marry their sisters, right? Why? Because they are too close. That's the idea. They are too close. You have to marry a stranger, somebody who is not as close. But what about when the world is only brothers and sisters? Then there are no sisters anymore, because the definition of a sister is someone who is closer to you than someone else. Dear, that is what a sister is. So therefore, in a generation when the whole world is only brothers and sisters, there is no provision against sisters anymore. The same thing. The Torah prohibits brothers to say the testimony against brothers, to be judges against brothers. This is when there are brothers and strangers, the Torah says this is the law about the brother. But when the whole world, the whole Jewish people is brothers and sisters, then of course they are 100% permitted. As a matter of fact, there is even an interesting midrash that some people take literally. I'm not sure if the real meaning is literal. That this tribes did marry their own sisters. You know, there is such a midrash. And that Shimon marries Dina, right? And the question is, how could they do such a thing? I mean, there is no prohibition anymore. You know, it's once we assume that this is the first generation of the Jewish people, there is no prohibition against marrying a sister when that's all there is in the world, because she's not a sister anymore. She is the only woman, right? Like Cain married his sister. Like Shaith marries his sister. Yeah.
That implies that the only reason not to marry a sister would be that she's close to her. We're not allowed to marry a sister or, you know, close relative like that, even if we didn't know they were a sister. It's also wrong, is it not?
Say it again.
What you're saying is if the only reason not to marry a sister or that brothers can't judge brothers is because we're too close to them, too involved.
Well, it's not a matter of, because I'm not saying the reason why the Torah decided. I'm saying the definition. What does it mean, a brother? Someone who is closer to you than someone else. So let the someone else be the judge, not you. But it can't be the commandment when the whole world is made up of brothers. You understand what I'm saying? Right? The Jewish world, and when the whole world was made up of brothers and sisters, right? When Cain decides to kill Hevel, right? In his mind, he's 100% justified. Because he's the world, right? So what, he's judging his brother. Is he allowed to? Of course. The world has a right to judge what's right and what's wrong. He thought that it was right. That was his justification, yeah. Well, that is partially correct. I mean, this is part of the case. Part of the case is... No. It's not a dream. I mean, if he's telling over the dream, right? And they realize that he is going to go to any extent to fulfill it. The proof is, look what he did. He came all the way to Shechem, right? Why is he coming to Shechem? Because he's pursuing his ideology. Doesn't that prove that he's very involved in this ideology, he's committed to this ideology, that he is going to be the king of Israel? That he's taking over the Malchut, the monarchy from the Jewish people?
He comes to Shechem because his father tells him to go to Shechem.
They don't know that. They see him as coming in order to fulfill the dream. That's the way they see it. Fine, I mean, this is today, and tomorrow, what is he planning to do for tomorrow? He has some kind of a plan. So why wait until he carries out the plan? And he causes all kinds of strife among the Jewish people. Obviously he has a plan, right? So he's a danger. Why don't we get rid of him from the beginning? Right? And once you put together this fact with the fact that he's the third generation of impurity, you say, well, then it's an excellent case. Why shouldn't we stop the sickness from the beginning? So in the beginning then they decide to kill him. What about our father? We have a certain obligation of honoring our father and minimizing his pain, right? What will be with the father? Well, we'll tell him it was an accident. As long as we didn't kill him, that meaning if we killed him, that would devastate the father. But as long as we didn't kill him, we won't tell the truth. No. As far as the father. As far as the father is concerned, as long as we tell him that we didn't kill him, but an animal killed him, that won't devastate him as much. But if we tell him the truth, that will kill the father. Who knows what it will do to the father? That we have an obligation towards our father. So let's make sure that we don't tell him, that's all. So, it was an almost unanimous decision. Almost. Not quite. In verse number 21, Vayishma Reuven Vayatzileyu Miyadam. Reuven gets up and he says, I vote against it. Lo nakenu nafesh. I don't agree to kill him. And he's the oldest, but he does not have the power of the oldest. He already had lost it. If you remember in last week's portion of the week, when there is the situation with Bila, he lost the right of the firstborn, and that's given over to Yehuda. Among the brothers, that's given over to Yehuda. So, what should we do? He was asked in verse number 22, Vaymalem Ruvain, Al tishpichu dam, hashlichu oto el abor. Let's throw him into the pit without killing it. Hasher bamidbar. Viyad al tishlichu bo. Let's not kill him ourselves. Oh, so now, what's the point that Reuven is making? He's going to die anyway, right? But at least we shouldn't kill him. So what difference does it make? So what difference does it make? So there is an incredible commentary here by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and he says the following. What Reuven was telling them, the case that he was making is the following. Listen, after all, we are only human beings. It's true. We think we are right. We have an excellent case. But after all is said and done, all we are is human beings. Human beings can err. Right? It's human. So why don't we do something better? Let's throw him into the pit. If he is guilty, he's going to die. If he's not guilty, then he's so not guilty that he must be righteous, because it's one of the two. If he's, the whole time he's just putting on a show of his righteousness, then he's such an evil person, obviously he's going to die in the pit. So what else might happen? That he's so righteous and we are so wrong that God will go out of his way to save him? That would be a proof that he's innocent.
And God will not go out of his way to save him if they kill him.
Says the Amigdavar Rabbi Berlin. He says, but if we kill him with our own hands, then we are using our free will. Then you can't expect God to save him. Here, I don't know if you realize what a shocking statement this is, which means, if something happens by accident, that means that God agreed with that accident. But if something happened that a person used his free will against the other person, don't blame God, blame the human being. This is what Rav Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, this is the case that Reuven is making here. The fact that God won't react, we will kill him, and God will allow it, that doesn't mean he's guilty. But if we throw him into the pit and he dies, then that will be a sign that he's guilty. So let's do that. This is what Reuven proposes, even though what he has in mind, Reuven, is something else. He has in mind that even if he's guilty, he likes to save him. But to the brothers, he presents the case. Let's throw him into the pit, and then we will see whether he's guilty or innocent, right? The ultimate test, the litmus test, whether he's guilty or innocent, this is what Reuven says. So, but of course, the pasuk ends in verse number 22. Leman hatziloto, what Reuven had in mind to eventually go over when nobody's watching, pick him out, take him out of the pit, and bring him to the father, right? And in this way, for the sake of the father, he will save his life. And this, in Reuven's mind, will be the ultimate rectification of his own sin. Because if you remember, his sin was the lack of respect for Yaakov's relationship. Remember that... moving the couch. Either in the literal meaning that he had relations with the concubine of his father, or according to the oral tradition says that all he did was to move out the couch of the concubine and put the couch of his mother. And what he did was just to show disrespect to the private life of his father, right? So in this way, he's bringing the son, the favorite son, to the father. In this way, he will rectify in his mind some of the part of the sin that he has committed. Okay, we'll stop here. Linetta will continue.